On Sunday, September 2nd at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents bassist, educator, and composer Cecil McBee. Join us as we discuss his compositions, session dates, and prepare for his upcoming Birdland appearance with the Cookers. That's Sunday, September 2nd at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is composer, bassist, band leader, and member of the Cookers, Cecil McBee. We're going to start off our program after our theme with Nina Simone with a song by Randy Weston, who transitioned yesterday morning. We're going to start off with African Village, Bedford Stuyvesant 1 from Spirits of Our Ancestors. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl starting now.
I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Cecil McBee.
Cecil McBee, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I appreciate the time you're going to spend with us.
I appreciate you calling.
I'm going to start at the beginning. I understand that you started playing clarinet and you switched to bass, or you started experimenting with the bass when you were 17.
Well, at about 12. Last year in elementary school, our class were shown a table full of instruments, which each were demonstrated by various artists. And we were asked if we liked the sound, perhaps you'd like to play the instrument. And I chose the clarinet.
You actually became proficient at it.
Oh, yeah. Upon entering the seventh grade, I fortunately got a position in the band by a bit of surprise to me because I knew nothing about the instrument and became rather proficient after 2.5 years to gain what was called first chair of the clarinet section, which was pretty respectful.
First chair, yes.
Yeah, and when I could look down to my left and nobody else existed except myself.
Wow.
So, hey, here we are. Well, so to speak.
You were offered a full scholarship as a result of this clarinet playing.
Well, upon entering my first high school year, I was now the second chair player of our big band, the concert band. The band was conducted by a guy named Clarence Fields, who was the brother of the great Ernie Fields, whose big band toured between Texas, Kansas City, Arizona, et cetera, during those days, during the 30s and 40s. And he introduced me as a newcomer to the band, and people applauded, and we began to play this tune, which wasn't played very well by the first chair guy, whose name was Ernie Fields, who was Clarence Fields, the band director's nephew. He was the son of Ernie Fields, the guy that headed the big band.
Right.
And he couldn't play very well. And I had never met the guy before, but turns out I was chosen to play that part that Ernie could not play, and I fluffed it also.
Oh.
And to the dismay of, I guess, everybody, it turns out, long story short, through that moment, I had been playing all the music by ear.
Oh.
And I was rushed into clarinet lessons. Later on, my junior year, I discovered the bass, et cetera, et cetera.
But you were offered a scholarship playing clarinet.
Yeah, I was. Of course, I was offered a scholarship
to college.
To Central State, at that time, College in Wilberforce, Ohio. And that's how I entered school.
And then you left to join the military. Was that your decision or you were drafted?
Well, I fell in love after about a year and a half.
Oh.
And quickly dropped my clarinet scholarship, which a single parent could no longer support. So I ended up in and out of school for about 2.5 years until the military called me. During my junior year, I ended up in the 158th Army Band out of Fort Knox, Kentucky, playing the clarinet. And in the meantime, I did mention that I had discovered the bass.
Right.
And had been playing in Tulsa and around the college campus, earning my living at that particular time. So in the Army, I'm now playing the clarinet to avoid the warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And, whatever that was, although that was during peacetime. But I had met Kirk Lightsey, who was a great friend of Joe Henderson. We all sort of corresponded and would frequently find ourselves in Louisville, Kentucky, playing jam sessions at night. So my career sort of rolled on that way. By the way, I had played with Dinah Washington before I went into the Army.
Yeah, I read that. What was that like? I mean, she was no joke as a band leader, I hear.
Well, she was rather interesting.
What does that mean?
Well, I've already contacted all my buddies and my mom at home that I'm very famous and I'm playing with Dinah Washington. I'm in Philadelphia where McCoy Tyner is the house pianist. Before he was ever in New York, they had pianists to play during intermission there.
Wow.
This is when What a Difference a Day makes. And we were in the dressing room and Dinah, quite frankly, there was a fifth of bourbon on the top of an old spinet piano, which she played very well. On occasion, she would sip very well, but was in the glass. So as a young kid, having been told before I left home, don't do that. Stay away from alcohol and stay away from those funny-looking cigarettes.
Uh-huh.
I listened to my parents and my elders, and I saw that as something that was rather unusual. And noticeably it was, because when they suddenly called her to enter the stage, she, upon approaching the mic, she would open with, "What a difference a day made." So she said, "What a difference a day made," and we would play it at a particular point. turns out I sounded awful, almost as awful as Ernie Fields did during that clarinet situation.
Uh-oh.
Why? Because her voice had dropped a whole step the previous night, and nobody told me that we were in a different key.
Wow.
So to answer your question, Miles Davis and his band from a place were on in a mission off a place called Showboat, which is about two blocks away from there. There was a horseshoe type of bar there. They were sitting right at the front. And when I played that note, Dinah Washington turned around and she called me every name that you could imagine.
Oh, goodness.
And the whole place, just they were so embarrassed for me. I'm just a young kid just trying to get a buck to get back to school. But unbeknownst to her, she did not know that I had received 3 days before that incident an induction into the Army. Because I could not finish school in time, so at that time they had the draft. If you didn't finish college in a certain time, you were in there.
Oh, my.
Yes. So later on, she told me, don't you do it again, blah, blah, blah. So what happened was she said, make sure you be tomorrow's night gig in Queens at certain times. And I said, yes, ma'am. Guess what?
You weren't there. Right. Oh, my goodness.
Because when she said something indecent to me, I was gone, no matter where it was. So that describes that particular situation.
Okay, then. when you left the military, you went back to playing in different clubs?
Well, when I was drafted, I needed one more year to finish college, at which I had really no money. So fortunately, the military provided all that. I saved my money over 2 years, went back to college, and got my degree in music education. And now that Kirk and I had become very close friends, I ended up in Detroit after I graduated from college. At, incidentally, Martin Luther King spoke at my graduation.
Oh, wow.
Yes, he and the great Dr. Charles Wesley, who was the nation's greatest historian of black culture, were very close friends.
And oh, my.
He was brought there to indicate to us what our plan should be towards goodness, otherwise, educationally. So I ended up in Detroit, where Kirk's mother kept me in his house for 3 months till I got my own apartment, during which I met Alice Coltrane, Elvin Jones. I was now in Detroit, where all those great people were. Even Motown was going on. That's when I really began my career, because that was an educational center of all levels of the music.
Wow.
I was very fortunate. Plus, I was playing pretty good, too.
That helped, I guess.
That helped a bit. I was considered a potential, let's say.
So when you were in college and you were following a curriculum that would lead you to education or teaching,
yes.
Were you also studying bass as well, or that was all on the bandstand?
That was all on the bandstand. I remind you, the clarinet was the most important instrument.
Right.
You know, that was the reason why I was there, so I studied it. But amongst other things, that was the greatest opportunity of all was the piano.
Mm.
You had to take, and I would advise any young student, especially all my students, if you're going to play music, you got to play the piano. That's the orchestra. And when I began tinkling around and learning to compose a bit, I ended up meeting Frank Foster, who was a graduate of Central State University. Also, Leontine Price was a graduate of Central State University.
Oh, my.
College.
Okay.
And so these people would infrequently visit the campus. I got a chance to meet Frank, and I took over his big band later on, because he had won a couple of years previously the National Award for Collegiate Orchestras.
Oh, wow.
And I took over the music and organized the band, conducted the band, and wrote some things for the band and so forth.
Oh, my goodness.
And that got me into composing pretty good.
Actually, that is something I wanted to ask you, because from what I understand, several of your compositions have become standards.
Really?
Well, that's what I read somewhere.
Whoa. Well, you've been hanging around with the right folks. Hey, that's interestingly enough, it has been said that the tune that I wrote upon first arriving in New York, called The Song of Her.
Yes.
Which was later on the second side of the great Forest Flower album.
Yes, Charles Lloyd.
Yes, that was my first composition recorded in New York. And that album, I understand, was the first album, so I was told by a DJ here in Maine, incidentally, I'm in the state of Maine now, that it was the first album that sold over 1 million copies. So
oh,
I
wow.
think Song of Her did get to be pretty popular, yes. We'll be right back.
Very nice. Now, we sort of jettisoned forward since we were talking about Song of Her, but I understand your first recording, though, was with Paul Winter. Is that correct?
Oh, my history agent just there. Of which I apologize.
Oh.
It was something that, quite frankly, is still to this date my most important recording. No.
Oh.
My very, 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 very first recording was with Motown.
Really?
Called Boss Bossa Nova.
Ah, okay, with George Bohannon.
With Kirk Lightsey and George Bohannon.
Okay.
And George Goldsmith.
Okay.
That I'm with Paul. long winter upon first having arrived in New York, during the strife of civil rights, I wrote an arrangement called We Shall Overcome. And nobody's heard that. It most definitely should be heard if I ask of you. We shall overcome to respect the great Dr. Martin Luther King and his effects. I don't think anybody's ever played that, but it's one of the better things that I've ever written as a college kid just having gotten out of college. I arranged it.
Is there a recording of that arrangement?
Paul Winter's Jazz Meets the Folk Song. It's something very special to me as a statement. At the moment, I'm getting off the ground or headed towards somebody that might be recognized as being able to compose or for a voice in music that expresses something of quality, educationally and also artistically. And the second one was with George Bohannon for Bowtown, and the third was the very first in New York for Columbia Records with Denny Zeitlin called Cathexus. C-A-T-H-E-X-U-S, Cathexus. And lastly, Some Other Stuff by Gracian Moncur. This is my second album in New York, which featured Herbie, Wayne, and Tony, Gracian Moncur, and myself. Some Other Stuff on Blue Note Records. As a side man. Thank you.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Our guest for this evening is composer and bassist Cecil McBee. Cecil McBee is also a member of the Cookers, which have a date at Birdland coming up, and it will be mentioned during our On the Bandstand segment, which is next. What you're listening to right now is Tandiwa. That's Gresham Moncourt III from Some Other Stuff, a 1964 Blue Note Records release. Gresham Moncourt III on trombone, Cecil McBee on bass, Wayne Shorter on tenor saxophone, Herbie Hancock on piano, Tony Williams on drums. Before that, we heard We Shall Overcome from the Paul Winter Sextet. This is from Jazz Meets the Folk Song, the 1964 Columbia Records release. Before that, we heard El Rig from George Bohannon Quartet from the 1962 Workshop Jazz release Boss Bossa Nova. Before that, we heard Song for Her from the Charles Lloyd Quartet. Forest Flower, Charles Lloyd at Monterey, 1967 Atlantic Records. Charles Lloyd on tenor saxophone and flute. Cecil McBee is the composer of this selection, and he's on bass. Keith Jarrett on piano. Jack DeJohnette on drums. Before that, we heard Sorta Kinda Blue from Cecil McBee's release as a leader, Alternate Spaces, the 1979 India Navigation release. Cecil McBee is the composer and bassist. Don Pullen is on piano. Chico Freeman is the tenor saxophonist. Joe Gardner, trumpet. Famido Don Moyer on percussion. And Alan Nelson on drums. Before that, we heard Slippin' and Slidin' from the Cookers, their Time and Again release, 2014 Motema Records. Cecil McBee is the composer and bassist. Billy Harper is the tenor saxophonist. Donald Harris on alto saxophone. David Weiss on trumpet. Eddie Henderson on trumpet. George Cables on piano. And Billy Hart on drums. Before that, we heard African Village, Bedford-Stuyvesant I, Randy Weston from the Spirit of the Ancestors release, 1992 Antilles Records. Randy Weston on piano, Alex Blake, Jamil Nasir on bass, Idris Suleiman on trumpet, TK Blue, Talib Kibwe on alto saxophone, Billy Harper and Dewey Redman on tenor saxophones, Benny Powell on trumpet, Idris Mohammed on drums, and Big Black on percussion. And of course, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. This is from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. It was originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams, and more from Cecil McBee and Sugar in My Bowl, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues. Thank you.
See, because I had your first release as being many years later, Motema.
Motema, oh, that was many years later.
Exactly.
That was the first album out of Strata East that would acknowledge me as composer past Shepley Bassist. I was now first in New York, only about 3 months, and on 3rd Street between Lafayette and Broadway, and staying with a guy, pianist, vocalist, whose name was Nat Jones, who manned a very extensive loft in which I stayed at the other end down there.
Okay.
$42 a month or something like that. Bob Crenshaw had heard Kirk Lightsey and I play in Detroit and recommended that if I ever came to New York, he'd find a place for me to stay, and that's what it was.
Oh, great.
So somebody knocked on the door, and a conversation ensued. After about 30 minutes, quietness. And later on, somebody knocked on my door, and I was practicing. And opened the door, it was Gracian Munker. I had never heard of the guy, and Gracian was a unique personality, you might say. I was quite impressed upon his introduction to me. He said, "Pardon me, Mr. Beckby, but I'm standing outside. Please forgive me listening to you play it. I'm impressed." He said, "I have a recording next Tuesday. Would you mind being, you know, a part of that?" And at the time, I was working on the addition of a third finger on my right hand, my pizzicato hand, which might add other things better to do during performance. And so there were a lot of flurries and all kinds of things. And, and he said, "Okay, great." He says, "Meet me at Lynn Oliver's studio on Tuesday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and then we'll go with it." So when I walked in, there was Herbie, Wayne, and Tony, and Grace himself. And I said, "I'm not ready for this." I was scared to death. And Gracian said, "When now time for music," I said, "What should I do with this?" There was all kinds of flurry stuff running all over the sides, top, bottom of staffs. He said, "Just play that stuff you were playing in practice. Don't worry about it. Just play openly."
Mm-hmm.
And so it was some other stuff meant we were just playing openly and listening and taking music from one situation to another, given the boundaries indicated. So that's how I really got into New York at that level.
So it was essentially improvised music.
Except a tune on the second side by Wayne, which was in 6-4.
Okay.
But everything else was wide open.
Wow. So I guess that also opened up the time that you spent recording with different artists on Blue Note.
Oh, yeah. I ended up with Wayne Shorter after that.
Yes.
That's what introduced me to Wayne Shorter and a couple of recordings with Herbie Hancock and so forth. And from that, I met Charles Floyd, who was at our concert.
Ah, okay.
With Wayne, Roy Haynes on drums, and Albert Daly on piano. And Charles Lloyd introduced himself to me and asked him to perform with him, Jack Legionette, and Keith Jarrett.
Wow.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for September 2nd. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's guest is bassist Cecil McBee. You can catch him at Birdland with the Cookers, including saxophonist Billy Harper, from September 4th through 8th. We have more listings for you this week, but first we have to bring you the sad news that there's one less artist we'll be following. Pianist Randy Weston joined the Ancestors on Saturday at age 92. Stay tuned for memorial or tribute news that we'll bring to you as we hear it. Walk good, brother. We start with bassist Christian McBride, who leads the New John Quintet at the Blue Note from September 4th through 9th. Drummer Milford Graves is at Brooklyn's Issue Project Room on the 6th. Saxophonist T.K. Blue is at Harlem's Greater Calvary Baptist Church on the 7th. Drummer Lenny White is at Kitano on the 7th and 8th with George Colligan's trio. Vocalist Kurt Elling is at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club from the 7th through the 8th for a tribute to John Hendricks. Bassist William Parker is at the Children's Magical Garden on Stanton Street in Manhattan on the 8th for a free outdoor concert, and that's part of Arts for Arts in Garden series. Trumpeter Ahmed Abdullah has a set on the 9th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions returns as a Saturday night series with late night sets at Smoke on the 8th and the 15th. Saxophonist James Brandon Lewis's trio is at the 73 C Gallery in Montclair, New Jersey on the 9th. Blues vocalist Alexis P. Souter is at the Bridgeport Theater in Connecticut on the 9th. Looking a little further ahead, drummer Billy Cobham and bassist Ron Carter are at the Blue Note from the 11th through the 16th. Drummer Bobby Sanabria leads the Multiverse Big Band in a free outdoor performance at the Amphitheater in Marcus Garvey Park on the 14th, and that's part of the Jazzmobile series. Saxophonist Rudresh Mahanthappa leads a trio at Arts Westchester in downtown White Plains on the 14th. Bassist Richard Bona is at Club Bonafide on the 14th and the 15th. Tubist Joe Daly is at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 15th and the 29th. Drummer Terry Lynn Carrington is at the Central Jersey Jazz Festival in downtown New Brunswick on the 15th. Guitarist Nels Klein and organist John Medeski are at Les Poissons Rouges with Chris Lightcap Superette on the 15th. Trumpeter Ahmed Abdullah and drummer William Hooker team up for an afternoon set at the Children's Magical Garden on Stanton Street in Manhattan on the 15th for a free outdoor concert, and that's part of Arts for Arts in Garden series. Guitarist Mark Rebo is at Brooklyn's Red Hook Jazz Festival on the 16th with the Jazz Bins. Saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin is at the Central Jersey Jazz Festival in downtown Flemington on the 14th. And the White Plains Jazz Festival on the 16th. Trumpeter Marcus Printup and harpist Reza Printup are at the Central Jersey Jazz Festival in downtown Somerville on the 16th. Lastly, guitarists Bill Frizzell and Mary Halverson are at Les Poissons Rouges on the 17th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link to the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news, and sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on the Sugar in My Bowl website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, September 16th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
You're tuned to WBAI,
the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
So he just heard you playing one time.
Well, Charles Lloyd is as unique as... He's a unique gentleman, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm being nice to Charles if you're listening. This was at the old Slugs downtown.
Okay.
There was an extended bar, modestly sized bar, right to the right of the bandstand. And given a full house, Charles Lloyd was through the whole second set of our performance, standing right at the corner of the bar, head full of hair, bouncing around, enjoying the music.
Oh, great.
And he said, when I approached the bar for a beer, he got my attention and said, "Hey, McBee, man," he says, "wonderful stuff you're playing there, man." Yeah, he says, "Look, I got a gig in Chicago in a couple of weeks. Are you interested?" I said, "Well, I don't recall anything on my calendar. Would you like to do an audition next week?"
Oh, sweat.
And I thought, I said to myself, "You just heard me play, man."
Exactly.
You know, and I incidentally flunked the audition.
What?
I'm one that I cannot play for you and try to prove something. I cannot do that. My stuff comes out on the stage. So 2 weeks after that, he called me and said, "Man, I couldn't find anybody else to make the gig. You got it."
Oh, wow.
That's true. So that's how the Charles Lloyd Quartet got started.
And you were with him for quite some time, and you were able to include some of your compositions?
The first was Song of Her, as I indicated. But Will Penn's Walk was the second one. more of a relatively brisk tempo in movement in terms of form is concerned. At the end of the major melody, that would be a sort of a Latin vamp that swings, advance, swings, advance. And so that was one of my second most popular tunes of an early arrival in New York.
Would I be stating this correctly? When you were playing with Charles Lloyd, was he the group that you were with when you first went to Europe?
Yes, that was the 66 Antibes Jazz Festival. I'm pronouncing it in French. It's actually Antibbe.
Yeah, how was that for you, leaving the country as a working musician?
Oh, my God. It was like, however, it was my second trip out of the country. My first was with Paul Weller to Brazil.
Okay.
To Rio in 65, a year before. But upon the plane descending in southern France, this is really into Nice, France, where the water is green and blue, palm trees, and all of that sunshine and stuff. Something I had never seen before. I just withhold any more of my romantic urges to get the hell out into it. You know, good wine, and beautiful this and that. You know, and it was wonderful. We were there a day early, so we got a chance to get our feet on the ground, and then we performed the following evening, where quite memorably, we were backstage. Every stage, you're separated by a curtain where Duke Ellington was featuring Ella Fitzgerald.
Wow.
And I'll put it like this. I ain't never seen nothing like that. You know, I just got in from Oklahoma, man. It's me, you know, looking at that and hearing all of that. It was wonderful.
Wow.
But quite frankly, the mindset of all of us was that we had played a couple of pretty sizable creative performances before we arrived at the Jazz Workshop in Boston.
Oh.
Yes. And we felt that, with all due respect, we couldn't wait to get on the stage and speak our minds, which is what we did. Especially with Keith Jarrett, it was a standing success for about 10 or 15 minutes.
Wow.
I mean, Keith Jarrett took a solo there, but I don't think anybody's heard that. And the band was just Jack, myself, and Charles. We were like, the music was flowing like honey. It's amazing.
That's great. So what made you move forward from Charles Lloyd?
Well, there was a incident in the band that caused me to move forward. There was a bit of a difference between one of the other guys that couldn't be acknowledged. I left standing, though.
All right. Good.
Believe it or not, although I had left, it was deep inside with tears in my eyes because I really loved that group. And, you know, the possibilities that we had before us were just absolutely stupendous in terms of my thinking. We had just broken ground, but there was a disagreement, like I said, between one of the members of the group. I don't know which one started it, but I ended up being exited, let's put it that way. Ironically, the very next gig was somewhere in Connecticut for the Charles Lloyd group. But I was playing with Yusuf Lateef on the same stage.
Oh, yes. And you recorded with him as well.
Oh, yes. It was certainly not a peaceful ending to the Charles Lloyd situation. I thought that there were some things happening on the bandstand that were not really plausible in terms of our physical, personal approach to the music that was already successful. There began to be a lot of physical clowning activity that, to me, that were distracting from the music.
Right.
I mean, seriously distracting.
Yeah.
I can't identify any of that, but it was, to me, personally, if we played music for the first, let's say, 15 to 20 minutes, we were lucky. And I made a comment about it, and that was it. Just called the meeting and said, you know, I thought we were, like, losing contact with the music, and that was it.
So it became more about, well, I guess what I'm thinking of is an example. There used to be sax players in the 50s during rock and roll or something. They would wail on the floor and something sort of like just clowning around physically when you could just focus on playing. That sort of thing. Is that what you're referring to?
Sort of, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And this was something that I thought went a little bit too far at times.
Yeah.
So I just made mention of it casually when we got back to the States in Philadelphia. And we were playing, believe it or not, at the Showboat. I said, McDee, you're out of here. That's how I left that band.
Okay.
But then I met Charles last summer in France, and we hugged and kissed.
Excellent.
Let's put it that way.
You hugged and kissed and made up.
Well, he did.
Yeah, he.
And I didn't kiss him.
Oh, gosh.
All being said, that was the most amazing experience musically that I can recall ever, and I still hold that in my system today. And being young at the time and at that age, you know, it was a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I'm sure people in the audience felt the same way.
Oh, well, people from Europe were there, all over Europe, and they followed us We were extended in Europe for a whole week at Golden Circle in Sweden.
Oh.
People followed us from that concert all over Europe throughout the remainder of the tour.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, it was happening.
Excellent.
After having become a big fan of Richard Davis, who just awed me because he was one that took the instrument itself and extended it harmonically and rhythmically. He transcended the bar lines legally, let's put it that way.
Wow.
And made amazing things happen, which really not only surprised me, but caused me to embrace that approach to the instrument. For instance, for the most part, you have these bar lines, these standing key things counted in an order, in sequence, et cetera, et cetera. He was one that, as I'm saying, would transcend those and the music would still sound the same. By transcending, I could use a word to say when things are sort of floating in the air, not recognizing these bar lines. There are a lot of things that can be done illegally that sound really, really good.
Illegally.
Or if you want to look at the dynamic of basic harmony, when you leave generally these two bars that are standing, once you've done something, said something within those two bars, you've got to legally cross the second bar line into another environment. And there's a way to do that. You can't just do that. There's certain things you have to do harmonically and even rhythmically to be received and for you to arrive safely and creatively.
Okay.
And Richard was able to do that, and he taught me that. So that's the way I sort of play now at times. I went with Pharoah Sanders for about 3 years, and then during when I was with Pharoah, which is why I brought up Richard Davis, because...
The creator has a master plan.
Yeah, Richard Davis was on that.
Okay.
And that's where I just picked up on him.
I see.
And I went personally to Pharoah and said, I want to join your band. I like this kind of music. And that's how I ended up with Pharoah for about 3 years, when I eventually met Alice Coltrane.
I want to hone in on the time that you were with Pharoah Sanders. Now, there's a release, Black Unity. Do you remember that session?
Oh, slightly, yes. During the civil rights movement, and Black Unity meant just that.
Yeah.
The music was wide open, and just vamping and vamping, and melodies invented and created simultaneous to places unexpected, and legally and illegally. People were dancing in the streets in the clubs where we played, you know, and that record was like in celebration of those moments where people were happy to be part of the movement, so to speak. Black Unity. We'll be right back.
Was that only played that one time in the studio, and it wasn't played after that?
I think so.
Okay.
Because Farrah's music was mostly centered around one simple harmony, and you can maintain a simple harmony for many reasons so long as you change rhythm, and that's what Farrah did at the time. And if you slow the tempo down or speed it up or put it in 3/4, 6/8, you keep the harmony, but the rhythm is always going to change. Like I said before, so long as the note is off the ground, that is not on the floor, like right. 1/2, that's when you can modulate, do things that might be illegal otherwise. That might be chromatically off course, but so long as it lands safely on the ground, it can sometimes, for the most part, work, and that's what we did. Even eventually to become very free and let everything just, like my uncle used to say, let all the hogs out of the pit. For Uncle James. Let all the hogs out of the pit, boy.
That's actually the kind of, quote, jazz that really stirs me. So I really enjoy that period of time.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. Well, it got me going, too, because during those spans, those stretches of sameness or mixed things, I had a chance to practice my instrument and find things that I didn't know in terms of real serious harmony, which is one reason why I left Farrah's band, because I now had begun to hear a lot of things that I wanted to maybe better connect with something that was more connected with what I was trying to say, not only as a composer, but soloist and arranger and orchestrator. I learned a lot. See, when you open one chord up that much, that long, you'll see a lot that you can use if you connect sameness of other orders. Instead of being all in B flat, you can now cross that bar line into D flat and go across the bar line into G flat, bringing the same kind of effort. Then you can find yourself more unique, not only style wise, but individually, which is what I've tried to do.
So you were mentioning having met Alice Coltrane. You recorded on her Journey to Satchitananda release.
Yes, that was absolutely an amazing experience. It was in John Coltrane's recording studio. He had just passed away the year before. Robbie and his brother were little kids, and I was very pleased to meet Alice again, because Alice I had met in Detroit when I was, you know, hanging out with Kirk Lightsey there. Alice had one of those big Victorian homes in which each and every Sunday, for the most part, folks who were in town, Elvin Jones, you name it, Train never showed up, Ron Carter, Paul Chambers, they would show up at her house 1:30 in the afternoon and play through the late hours. And her name was Alice McLeod then. So now that she's Alice Coltrane, we were back together again on a more serious note with making that album, which I think people seem to like pretty good.
Oh, yeah. There was also a period where you worked with Chico Freeman.
Yes, and there was a time when Chico Freeman worked with me.
Did he work with you first?
Yes, we would hang around and play gigs at the Sweet Basil.
Oh, yeah. That was here in New York.
Yeah.
How did you wind up calling him in to play with you?
Good question. Oh, he came and asked me to set in with. And he reminded me of someone who was making a great effort of discovering himself past the ordinary expectation of what was happening harmonically. First, it was harmonically, and that helped him find his way more individually, soloistically. He was exploring like I was, so we got along real well and got to be really close, very close friends.
Well, I noticed also while you were recording with Pharoah Sanders, you then recorded as a leader on Mutima.
Yes. Well, that was an opportunity that came about through Graces of Strata East, which was an organization founded to safeguard, preserve jazz music throughout the world. And through a corporation, by corporation, financially, with everybody contributing this or that, I ended up financially with the ability to record my first album featuring my compositions. And I stretched all the way out.
Yes.
Mutima, which means from the heart, it's one of my grandest compositions that hasn't been heard yet.
What do you mean that hasn't been heard yet?
Harmonically, it is one that fluidly discovers various borders excitingly, only to conclude towards another one rhythmically and even more harmonically, with a nice smooth feeling of resolutions and surprising moments of positiveness. It, this whole sound collectively, it's very, very positive sound.
Uh-huh.
Not just out of one order of things, but connecting about five, let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different keys. smoothly transitioning from one key to another, which was an example of learning from when I played the things that I learned having played with Sarah Sanders. You remember all those open things. Once I put bar lines down, I knew how to get from place to place more uniquely unto my own. That was reference, you know, things that I did with Sarah.
Mutima, there is a selection, one of your compositions, called Mutima.
Yes.
That can be heard.
Yeah, but it's one of my favorite. I love it.
Okay.
Occasionally, I sit at the piano to this day, just to soothe and get me past certain moments that might be a little bit bumpy. The second album was...
Alternate Spaces.
Alternate Spaces,
yes.
That was an opportunity to lay the bar lines down and explore out there. And to this day, that could hit my most favorite albums that I've done. Because the expectation is the unexpectation or any expectation of what it should be. Harmonically, rhythmically, and the word verbally seems to come to mind. I think I really came close to satisfying some urges that I had distinctly as a composer.
And all of the compositions on this are from you as well?
Yes.
Composed everything here?
Everything.
How did you wind up selecting the personnel on this one? I noticed Don Moyer and Don Pullen and Alan Nelson, Joe Gardner.
Well, Don Pullen, to me, was a very fluid, rhythmic type player.
Yes.
But very harmonic and very romantic in its approach to things that perhaps would not expect that kind of approach. So there was a good mixture of his spirit, which is what I try to do when I play. The expectation might not necessarily arrive at the right time. And Don Moyer was one who was just rhythmically, his style called for you to listen a bit closer because conceptually he was usually very busy. You had to figure out a lot of the times what he was doing. And if you listen very closely, he was. But he wasn't a lot of times. But he was. And when it came time to conclude, he was usually right there. And if you put the three of us together, then things were pretty loose. However, you know, in order. And that would help me fashion the melodies and harmonies that I felt that were unique to my thinking at the time. Because I was very strong to discover sounds that I had not heard before in terms of their qualities of flavors. That is, when a tone should resolve here or go there, I would usually take it to another place, referencing where the beat is in a more unexpected sort of fashion. Then I could make contact with more momentarily what I had intended to say intrinsically. Because when you compose music, the most important thing is whether or not it's how you understand where the beat is and where the beat isn't. As I said before, when things are moving and there's no beat announced or intended, you can do a lot of things with that. And I spent a lot of time trying notes and tones out as they would move towards something and away from something to indicate the private nature of myself and so forth, what I'm trying to say as a human being, trying to play the bass and writing music on the piano.
Since, you know, your thing was education, did you eventually wind up teaching music?
Yeah, I'm at the New England Conservatory of Music right now.
So that's what I thought. And so how is it for you to communicate your lesson plan? Is it more show than tell? Are you more instructive visually using your instrument as opposed to talking about it?
I am more talking about it because I do know mostly what this stuff is about at this particular time. As a matter of fact, when I first entered New York, my grand desire was to compose classical music and conduct classical orchestra. I really fancied that, but had to earn a living. Although in college, I studied nothing else, barely got out of school, and I was superb in my music classes. I just had my mind on music at all times. And so I think one who is fairly well acceptable that can explain or indicate fairly well what the functions of this music are musically, harmonically, rhythmically. Mm-hmm. I feel that I'm very, very, very good at that by now. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I just released, a book called Anthologies of String-Based Improvisation.
I saw that. You have two books though, right?
It's three.
Okay.
And I have, from beginning to end, I have indicated up front the very, very basics of what a tone is, how to connect the tones, what basic theory of harmony is, even to a bit more advanced, into connecting and placing the tones on the fingerboard, finding the tones on the fingerboard, making sure that they move properly from one environment to another to indicate what scale, what chord, et cetera, et cetera. As a matter of fact, I think viable information for the beginner all the way through the advanced. And it is now completed as of the last year and a half, and I have somebody out now, Jonathan Blunk, who happened to be my first student at the time years ago, researching as to what publisher might be interested.
Okay.
It's a manual. It's a combined three manuals I think should be on the shelves of music institutions everywhere, indicating the functions of the bass improvisationally.
That's great. Well, I hope it does find a home so everyone can access it.
Yeah, it's basically for students and musicians who have a little bump in the road in terms of what they need to know.
There are like two sort of workplace bands that you're participating in. One of them is Saxophone Summit.
Yes.
And the other is the Cookers.
Yes, and there's one other.
Uh-oh.
There's Josuke Yamashita, the New York trio out of Tokyo.
Oh, could you tell me about the first two and then tell me about the third?
The Saxophone Summit? Well, hey, that's about 12 years ago. Dave Liebman called me at the time. Michael Brecker was the saxophonist. Said that he wanted somebody. He had tried a couple of other very fine instrumentalists whose concept did not quite coincide or mix with his concept, which is very intervallic, very chromatic, and he wanted somebody to settle everybody down who knew how to place the notes within various environments that would give them better direction in terms of what they were trying to do, although they were out there above and away from those bar lines. And I'm one that is always not only listening for various things to do, whatever they are, but I'm quite astute and ready to change at the drop of a moment, when necessary, I should say. When Michael finishes his last note and Joe Lovano plays, I change courses in terms of what his situation, his concept is, harmonically.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are playing some great, great music out there. So Dave called me and asked me to play, and I've been with him about 11, 12 years.
Super. And the Cookers, you actually are going to be here in New York. You're going to be at Birdland from Tuesday the 4th through Saturday the 8th.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to that.
There's somebody who's going to be playing with you as part of the Cookers. He was also with you as part of the Saxophone Summit, Billy Hart, drummer. Jabali.
Yes. Jabali. Yeah, Billy and I, we go all the way back. You know,
mm-hmm.
Wherever somebody's doing something like that, we're usually the drummer and the bass player.
Yeah, I noticed. How did you wind up meeting and working together?
Just on call. Just various gigs that would come up. Hey, man, I saw you last week. How you doing? I see I'm with you next week. You know,
because
we both were rather fluid in motion. And like I said, as I would perform with the Saxophone Summit, anything and everything that's happening on the stage, Billy and I conceptually, individually, can make some support helpful, healthy weight a lot of the time.
So when David Weiss decided to put together the cookers of You Cooking People.
Us Cooking People?
Yes.
This used to taste my ribs and my barbecue bologna. But anyway.
So he just called whoever he thought was going to make it work, and you've just been together ever since?
Dave is a pretty sharp guy. He wanted, first of all, composers that wrote pretty well to help present the music in a more mixed, and a lot of the stuff would be music that would ordinarily not be expected to sound otherwise. He wanted people that were sharp to attention of not only composition was, but what playing together were, and people that could work together and make great music that perhaps hadn't been played before in that style or that way. And we seem to have found some reasonable success in playing almost everything that's required from us.
Right.
Remember, some of it didn't work, but most of it does.
Yeah, and I think the great part is the fact that you're able to bring your compositions to the table. It's really nice that it's that kind of collective.
Yes, I feel very, very blessed that he's featuring four of my compositions, because although I pursued and pursued and pursued and pursued once again, being a band leader, I've been seen more as a sideman that seems to shine pretty back there.
Right.
So here I get a chance to stand up front and band leaderize for a minute.
Right. The group in Japan that you were telling me about.
We've got one here, New York Trio. The leader of the group, his name is Yosuke, Y-O-S-U-K-E, Yamashita, Y-A-M-A-S-H-I-T-A. Yamashita is the Japanese pronunciation. The American is Yamashita.
Okay.
He plays piano, and he very noticeably loves Cecil Taylor. He's one hell of a great pianist who loves that kind of energy with notation in order. In other words, he plays very, very melodically, but very furiously and very outside and inside and makes things work. And the drummer's name is Firon Akloff. And we're celebrating our 30th year this year together as a group.
Oh.
But we're more locally in Japan.
Okay.
At the beginning, we played a lot at Sweet Basil, so we ended up going to Japan every year. After 30 years, we've done 29 recordings.
Wow. I can't wait to hear this. I'm going to have to find something so I can play something. What do you suggest I play?
Let me see. Kurdish dance. K-U-R-D-I-S-H dance. Featuring Joe Lovano.
Okay. Do you have a desire to record as a leader again?
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I've got several tunes that are readily available right now that would, I think, extend from there and now towards another place past my expectations. Mm-hmm. If I were surrounded by my own compositions at this point in time with me playing the bass that way. Alternate Spaces was intended, but I didn't quite achieve that compositionally. Things were a bit more important. But if I would record now and given time to develop rather than starting at 12 o'clock and finishing at 7 o'clock and you've done an album, I could perhaps say what I'd like to say at this point in time. But I've reached around and there seems to be a little, every now and then, a little interest. But I've done a lot of writing lately. As a matter of fact, my wife and I have just recently produced a CD which provides 9 of my compositions. But she, being a vocalist, has written the words, the lyrics for these, and she is singing all the music. She has written the lyrics to 8 of my compositions, and I wrote the lyrics to 1. So we're trying to find a place for a CD release advantage.
Well, first off, what should have happened is you need to introduce your wife to the listening audience. What is her name?
Her name is Verena Megby. She's out of Germany. Her family name is Gimsa, G-E-M-S-A, Verena Gimsa. She records under Verena Megby. Well, upon first arriving in New York and meeting me, I asked her if she had heard of Sarah Vaughan, and she said no, and she liked jazz music, so when she heard Sarah Vaughan, she's been singing ever since, so, and she's working, honing her trait.
Be something that we'll look forward to.
Okay, thank you.
Could you tell me one more thing? You played with Woody Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
Did he come to you, or did you go to him?
How did that come about?
There's one recording that you actually do with Freddie Hubbard and Woody Shaw, Double Take.
Yeah, Double Take, I know that one.
Could you tell me about that recording experience?
It was. I can hear a chuckle in your voice.
Yes.
I played with Freddie Hubbard first.
Okay.
Playing gigs around town, even recording with him. I did a record called Four Quartets, which McCoy Tyner headed, and I had met Freddie Hubbard on it, Bobby Hutcherson, people like that.
Uh-huh.
So I ended up occasionally playing some things with Freddie, and occasionally Woody would come along and sit in, so I ended up playing some things with Woody, spending some time with him.
I interviewed Freddie Hubbard once, and he was just a laugh riot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so was Woody. So, yeah, I hear you saying that together. Yes, it was a riot. It was always a riot. I don't know how we got it. If you look at that album cover, they both still laughing.
Right. Oh, my gosh. You know, I'm hesitant about even asking about these things as your side projects, because I know you would want to discuss your compositions more. That would be the conversation to have. But just looking at the list of people that you had played with, and there's one that I did want to ask you about, Abdullah Ibrahim. You played with him when he was Dolebrand and as Abdullah Ibrahim.
Yes, I did. And he was both at the same time.
Right.
So. Depending on the moment. He was a unique model of humanity who sought that high level of excellence through person and through the music, and exemplified that on and off the stage. But harmonically, he was very, very tender from whence it came. You know, the southern world at that time in Africa, harmonically, was not too far past one or two, three notes in the chord. You'd be 1-3-5, 1-3-5, which moved around from here to there rhythmically, which kept the ear in touch with the flavor of the mind of the composer of that region. There were very little things that were altered. As a matter of fact, speaking of performing in Japan, you might know that the basic scale from the beginning of time is the pentatonic scale, five-tone scale, and which the Asian people now still adhere to. I mean, this is their thing. So when we came along, other classical composers and performers came along, adding other tones chromatically or scale-wise, they just went off, given the quality of difference. The South Africans have yet to do that. Just stay with that triple triad. It gives flavor to what they're about. I think it's wonderful.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, this will be the last thing I ask, because, you know, I could keep talking to you, and this has to end at some point.
Oh, that's quite a tribute. Thank you.
You've mentioned several times about, not in these particular words, but sort of order and being grounded. Sort of like just feet on the floor, kind of, you know, touching the floor. Is that basically how you like to live and play?
Hell no.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Hell no. I'm still a child ready to spring off the nest.
Excellent.
And so forth, what I do. But my CD, Alternate Spaces, it was then, at the release of Alternate Spaces, that it was, given the nature of the music, it was said that it was music that shouldn't even be listened to by a noted jazz company at the time.
Oh, because of the explorations that you took?
Yeah.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Wow.
That was a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
But if you look around, Cecil McBee's music is unique to my own.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said before, I approach my statement, again, unique to who I am deep inside. I have to say that. And I have been successful in finding a way to exclaim that collectively with other events. For instance, I will sit at the piano, play a sound, mm-hmm. and another sound, and respond, and like it. And if I don't, erase it, and keep going till I'm satisfied. Mm-hmm. And that becomes a tune, and then I'll put it in some kind of order. Mm-hmm. My tunes are usually a series of thoughts.
Okay. Well, Cecil McBee, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I really, really do appreciate all of the time that you spent with us having
this
conversation.
Thank you so much. May I say one more thing?
Please.
The album that my wife and I have produced is titled Euphoria.
Okay. Excellent.
Okay.
So we'll keep an ear out for Euphoria when you make it available.
I do appreciate that. And thank you for calling me.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening was bassist and composer Cecil McBee. What you're listening to in the background is Kurdish Dance from Yosuke Yamashita. That's from his release, Yosuke Yamashita. This is a 1992 Verve release. Yosuke Yamashita is the composer, and he's on piano, Cecil McBee on bass, Joe Lovano on tenor saxophone, Firon Aklav on drums. Before that, we heard the title selection from Mutima. That's a 1974 Strata East release from Cecil McBee. Cecil McBee is the composer and bassist. Onaji Allen Gomes on acoustic piano and electric piano. Tex Allen on trumpet. Art Webb on flute. Master drummer Michael Carvin on gong and percussion. Jabali Billy Hart on percussion and cymbal, and Jimmy Hops on drums. Before that, we heard an excerpt from Black Unity. This is the title selection from Farrell Sanders' 1971 Impulse Records release. Farrell Sanders on tenor saxophone and vilophone, Hannibal Marvin Peterson on trumpet and vocals, Carlos Garnett on tenor saxophone, Joe Bonner on piano, Cecil McBee and Stanley Clark on bass, Norman Connors and Billy Hart on drums, and Lawrence Killian on congas, talking drums, and vilophone. Before that, we heard Will Pans from Charles Lloyd Quartet. The Flowering is 1967 Atlantic Records release. Charles Lloyd on tenor saxophone. Cecil McBee is the composer and the bassist. Keith Jarrett is on piano and Jack DeJeanette on drums. And before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned. La Nueva Alternativa is scheduled next. And Sugar in My Bowl should return on September 16th. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.